Let's talk. John Brown. Zero sum. When the hammer and sickle came down in late 1991, Russia's feverish new market opened for business. From banking to breweries, sex has emerged out of nowhere in a country that had never had a functioning economy. For the next three turbulent decades, a wild proto-capitalist free-for-all transformed Russian society. Then in 2022, Putin launched the full-scale invasion of Ukraine. It is the subject of a fascinating new book called Zero Sum, The Arc of International Business in Russia, and it is by Charles Hecker, who I'm delighted to say joins me now live from London. Charles, good morning to you.
Good morning, Giles.
And you were in Russia during this this very interesting, memorable period of the former Soviet Union's existence.
That's right. I was on the ground in Russia starting in the 1990s, which was really sort of one of the wildest times in Russia's history. I mean, this was a moment after the collapse of the Soviet Union, when Russia was essentially making it up as it went along, politically, economically, culturally, in terms of society. This was a sort of hormonal teenage country just getting on its feet.
I'm always fascinated by the former Soviet Union because of all it has basically been a petri dish of ideas that possibly went wrong. Because if you think about Marx and his idea about communism, he meant that to be in Germany or France or Great Britain. And so, but Russia, which had been under feudalist czarist rule for centuries, got it and did what they did with it. And let's not even go there. And then they become, in 1991, the picture just flips a 180 and it becomes this, okay, let's do capitalism on steroids. Because I remember the great, whilst we were all getting carried away, and you and I are probably around the same age because we're both in the flush of youth, Charles, I can tell.
I hope I'm as young as you are.
Yeah, well, yes, it's a filter, trust me. But whilst we were all, you know, literally, you know, in tears with the coming down of the wall, etc. And it seemed that, you know, now the Soviet Union or Russia would be open to you know, to democracy, and we thought, great, we're going to put in, you know, Starbucks, McDonald's, we're going to throw everything of Western capitalism in, and they're just going to immediately become sort of happy shoppers. The reality, of course, was a distinct Russian take, and when you know the Russian people, then we maybe should have seen this coming.
You know, it's a great comparison, and you're absolutely right. I mean, if you go way back, you know, 100 years ago or so, Russia was not the place for the proletarian revolution. Russia was not supposed to be the place for, you know, sort of the Bolshevism and the Bolshevik revolution to take root. You're absolutely right that the workers' revolution was supposed to start in the industrialized West. But you're exactly right. You know, we are where we are, and the Bolsheviks took root where they took root. And the exact same thing, in a manner of speaking, happened with capitalism. You know, Russia was not ready for what the West unleashed on it, starting in 1991, following the collapse of the Soviet Union. I mean, there's somebody quoted in the book who said, you know, there might have been maybe 20 or 30 people in the entire Soviet Union at the time who knew what a profit and loss account was. And of course, a profit and loss account is the absolute sort of touchstone of running a business in a market economy, in a capitalist system. And you're right, the West threw billions and billions of dollars in private investment, in government money, and in sort of political goodwill, trying to make a liberal democracy and a market economy out of Russia. And yeah, you know, there were Snickers billboards everywhere, and there were McDonald's restaurants everywhere you looked, and all of those, we thought, were indications that Russia was moving in the right direction. But it turns out that, you know, you can eat a lot of Big Macs, but it doesn't mean that you're in a capitalist economy.
One of the things that capitalism needs is an educated population and a tradition of entrepreneurship, okay? People who want to start their own businesses. Now, when you have, and listen, I live in Spain, and we were under a dictatorship by Franco for 40 years, and there is a massive sort of state structure there. And when you have a state structure that looks after everything, cradle to grave, then it's not in the interest of any state that is totalitarianism to have free thinkers, people want to start themselves. So you have a brain drain from Russia before the Soviet Union. Free thinking isn't allowed. So the only people who think on their feet are perhaps the people that, I'm going to phrase this nicely, Charles, the people who skirt on the margins between, who are in the import-export business and perhaps have a more colourful look at business. And they came to the fore, you know, and again, turbocharged, you could say.
You might be referring to this group of individuals who grew up to become known as the oligarchs. But so here's the twist. You're absolutely right, again, Giles. And that is that, I mean, the Soviet Union had a powerful educational system, and so does Russia. And what was interesting was that the younger you were at the time of the collapse of the Soviet Union, I mean, there was a real cutoff when you were sort of older than 40, older than 50, you know, much older than us, Giles.
Absolutely, yes.
If you were older than a certain cutoff point, you just didn't get it. It was really hard to adapt to what was happening. But because the Soviet Union and subsequently Russia was full of incredibly well-educated young people, they started to get it. And they switched fairly quickly. They started to understand things like currency arbitration and trade negotiations. And they started to understand what profit and loss was and, you know, what the principles were of market dynamism. And so this young generation of Russians, which, by the way, were the people who were most aggressively courted by Western investors, you know, they wanted the folks who were in the physics departments and the mathematics departments and graduating from Moscow State University. These were also the folks who spoke English. It was that youngest generation at the time that grasped this with both hands and has been riding it ever since.
Is it the case that a lot of the educated, these young people who grasp it, took the opportunity to move to investment banking as a Russian expert in London or New York or Paris rather than staying in Moscow? And the people who stayed in Moscow, perhaps, because of the, you know, the Banditsky who came afterwards and said, well, actually, yes, this is wonderful, great, but I want to have a Bentley dealership there, and I've got an interesting club here, and nothing moves in restaurants with that. And you get that sort of, that's happening at home. So a lot of young Russians did take the opportunity to get out and experience Europe, because you could argue that, although, and this is two-pronged, sorry, Charles, although we are looking at, the West made the mistake at looking at Russia as almost European, but if you've known the Russians and you've hung out with Russians, you know that the mindset of Russians is definitely Slavic and definitely different in a huge way.
That's right, although I should add, just on top of that, that Russians themselves consider themselves European. Mm. I mean, you know, look, the country goes all the way from bordering on the Baltics in the west, all the way to Vladivostok and bordering sort of on the Sea of Japan to the east. So it's absolutely massive and takes up more than 9 time zones. So, but Russians themselves do consider themselves European. And all you had to do during the go-go days was try to book a plane ticket on British Airways. And you understood just how incredibly intense the traffic was back and forth between Moscow and London. I mean, it was genuinely impossible to get a seat on a BA aircraft at the peak of the Russian boom. On the topic of sort of who was getting educated where and who was staying at home, that kind of came in waves. You're right to say that there were plane loads. I mean, there were just truckloads of Russian students going from Moscow, St. Petersburg, all the big cities, to Harvard Business School, to Wharton, to London Business School, and getting very fancy, very expensive MBAs, and then coming back and transplanting that Western business education onto the Russian market. But you're absolutely right to point out that there was a point where, I mean, I lived around the corner from a Bentley dealership.
Yeah.
So, you know, and it was a booming business. So there was enormous incentive to make money and stay at home. But it was that integration with the rest of Europe, and it was that integration with the global economy that I think drove a certain cohort to go out and get expensive MBA degrees and get onto that sort of international bandwagon.
And as well as that, it was the first time that many of them and their parents would only have dreamed about this. It's the free movement. I mean, I'm based in Marbella, and trust me, you know, we have seen an awful lot of Russian investment, as has Costa Blanca, as has Mallorca stuff, Cyprus, Dubai, Turkey. Suddenly, Russians were there, and they were buying, and they were the kids in the candy stores, as you would say. They were excited, and they were moving in, and this was so. This is all great, and there's movement, and the whole thing, and Russia's a new booming business, and there's that whole, you know, they're getting very interested in the Gulf states and Cyprus and everything else. But in the meantime, the 8,000 pound bear in the corner of the room, which is about to be woken up, is the political system. Because although, you know, the markets may have changed, the political system definitely hasn't.
Yeah, we're going to get a little bit serious now.
We have to at some point. It's Russia, for goodness sake.
And so the political system in the 1990s that we all hoped and thought and dreamed and imagined, that it looked and felt like a democracy, because, you know, we had Boris Yeltsin, we had multi-party elections, we had elections, you know, that was all looking like it was moving in the right direction. But when you get beneath the surface, really what happened in the 1990s did very, very little to create the fundamentals, the foundations, and the institutions for a robust democratic political system.
Just a quick one. How much, because we looked at Yeltsin as a sort of like, you know, buffoon, half-cut figure on the world stage going, oh, well, there's a drunken Russian, basically. How much damage do you think that did internally? Because, you know, in the UK, they're now saying, oh, well, the adults are back in control now. And somebody like Yeltsin, somebody like, you know, Putin is sitting there. And let us not forget how patriotic Russians are about their country. I mean, the huge amount of people who were wasted in the war, the Great Patriotic War, that still is a main vein. You don't have to see the rhetoric that's coming out of Moscow now. So this is seen as a slight on the name of Mother Russia. So somebody like Yeltsin, who doesn't even get off the plane because he's too emotional island, shall we say. That is the problem. People remember that and him dancing on stages and inappropriate kissing, as it be now. Imagine Yeltsin in the Me Too movement. But, and yet, you know, Russia, there are people who want, you know, you do not muck with the KGB, and they're sitting there appalled, and this obviously gives a groundswell, which is how we got to where we are now, Charles.
Yeah, I guess, you know, in terms of the damage that was done, I guess, you know, and we have the benefit of hindsight now, but I suppose it's really a story of a missed opportunity, that Yeltsin and the people who surrounded him had perhaps a golden opportunity really to reform a country and to set it off in a certain direction. And I think ultimately, perhaps because Yeltsin, the figure himself, you know, turns out to be quite tragic. And also because really a country with the size, you know, the size of Russia, the history, the traditions, and just that moment in Russia, you really can't turn around a country like that in the space of a decade. And, you know, maybe he tried, or maybe he wasn't the right guy at the right time. But I think now those 10 years really, until he resigned, as you remember, on New Year's Eve of the millennium, you know, when we were all a bit busy doing something else. He resigned with a job, I guess, in retrospect, that was unfinished. And of course, that's when Mr. Putin comes in. And after a few early, maybe promising first few years, things really did begin to change.
When do you think the sort of warning signals began to sort of ping? Is it the what happens in Chechnya? Because that is a warning to it should have been a warning to everybody, but it was sort of almost seen as an internal affair. But if you look at that, and then you look at interference in Georgia and Shevardnadze, and then you look at obviously the situation we have now in the Ukraine. And his background. I mean, I've interviewed Gavin Essler about this, and I've interviewed John Sweeney, and I think Gavin called it it's become into a kleptocracy, because friends of Putin's became very, very wealthy almost overnight. But it was definitely being a friend of Putin's is a poison chalice.
So, again, taking advantage of hindsight.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for interviewing me now and not 20 years ago. You know, the signs were there. If you wanted to look at them, or if you saw them, or if you were really switched on enough and had that perspective as the history itself was being made and unfolding in front of us. And in the book, you know, I spoke to more than 70 executives and government officials and analysts and people who were on the ground at the time doing the doing in Moscow and in Russia. And there were a few people who, as this was all happening, they said, you know, something just wasn't adding up. And they point to lots of different spots along the timeline. And you've mentioned a bunch of them. But it includes also things like the sinking of the Kursk submarine and Putin's handling of that national tragedy. And that was in the first year of his presidency.
Injecting grieving mothers live on air, etc., when they're protesting, for example.
There was that. And then I think what really switched everybody on, when it was perhaps already too late, was a speech that Putin gave at the Munich Security Conference in 2007. And so this is already 7 years into his presidency, but he basically gets up at this extremely prestigious international forum where the great and the good of geopolitics are all sitting in the room. And he says, basically, you know, this whole sort of US-dominated, Western-oriented geopolitical system that's been around for decades, he basically says, you know, this isn't for us, and I'm not into it. And that was the moment when everybody said, right, we got to get busy dealing with this.
Businesses then who got involved, you know, with Russia. I mean, now that obviously must have been completely horrifying. When we saw the tanks going back on trailers at the, you know, from Belarus, that whole orchestra thing, my thoughts went immediately back to the sort of great Stalinist propaganda movies when they're all waving and saying goodbye, and we were only looking, honestly. And then they invade Ukraine, and Kyiv seems to be getting a fall in 48 hours, etc. But then it all grinds to a halt because perhaps they can talk the talk, but unfortunately, after years of kleptocracy, you know, perhaps it isn't functioning as cleanly as they all thought. But businesses must now look at that and go, we didn't think it would go that far, because suddenly then the sanctions come in. You know, friends of mine who were trying to charge their electric cars on their Russian phones found themselves stranded because the system would be blocked and they couldn't charge their electric cars. But joking aside, Russian money is frozen. Everything is frozen. All the business just comes to a grinding halt.
Yeah. So on the subject of kleptocracy, and this is important, you're right, because Putin took over a system that was enormously criminalized and that had grown during the Yeltsin period. And what he did essentially in building his kleptocracy, as opposed to Yeltsin's kleptocracy, is he took that sort of criminalized world and essentially sort of brought it in-house and made the government sort of the main agent in the business world, as opposed to what Yeltsin had done. And so, you know, fast forward to 2014 and the little green men who took over Crimea, and then 2022 and the full-on invasion of Ukraine. You know, there's a guy who I interviewed for the book who I think summarized it absolutely beautifully. And he said, you know, geopolitics was bad, but business was good. And this is at a time, you know, up to and sort of including Crimea, when business in Russia was booming and Western investors, you know, their Russia divisions were some of the best performing parts of their businesses, you know, outperforming their French business or their Spanish business or you know, their UK divisions.
Yeah, we have a World Cup, for goodness sake, that passes off with that incident. You know, it's that seems to say, hey, Russia is part of the global football family, the sports family.
You know, doesn't it feel like a million years ago that the World Cup was in Russia and the Olympics, the Sochi Winter Olympics in 2014, were in Russia? And you're right. These are the number one symbols of a country being integrated into global society. You get the Olympics, you get the World Cup, and they were hugely successful. Although we should, you know, the Sochi Olympics were known for this industrial scale doping. And it was right after Sochi that the little green men were on the ground in Crimea. So Crimea was, for those who cared to see it, Crimea was a bit of an inflection point. But again, you know, in the global scope of things, you're kind of thinking Russia's big, business is good. Crimea, you know, kind of a corner down there.
Yeah.
What are we supposed to think?
Let it slide. Let it slide because, hey, what's it going to make? It's not going to make a much of a difference. And you know, and look at the profits we're bringing in.
Precisely. And then I guess, you know, look, the war started and I think a certain sense of panic set in. And all you had to do is be on the ground and see what was going on in the airports. And it was just sort of everybody for the life rafts, everybody for the exits.
Mm.
And then sooner or later, once the people all left, and once it was obvious that the war was not going to be, you know, quick and dirty, once it was obvious that the war was really, you know, digging in for the long haul, the companies started to leave as well.
What was the spark then for you writing this? What was the thing that, you know, set you, with your perspective that you thought, right, this I've got to write this now?
Yeah, thanks for asking. I mean, I think that all good stories, whether it's a book or a movie or a story that you're telling a friend, all good stories have a beginning, a middle, and an end. And the beginning of the Russia story properly was the early 1990s. And the middle was, you know, was this absolute sort of golden era of the 2000s of just, you know, minting it from a Russian business, from a Western business perspective. And also remember, you know, in the 2000s, in the early 2000s, Moscow was a super glamorous global capital. And, you know, this is where Jennifer Lopez was coming in to sing at oligarchs' birthday parties, you know, super mega city. And then it has an end. And it's a messy end. And that's with the start of the war. So what you get really is a narrative story arc from beginning to middle to end that I thought would be something that would be really interesting to tell, to get down on paper and to put out in a book.
When you look back at this and you look at the situation now, is it bittersweet? Is it the missed opportunities, the could have beens, the what ifs that strike you?
Yeah. I think almost everybody, with the exception of the man in the Kremlin, I think almost everybody wanted this to turn out differently. You know, this is happening at a time when everyone in the world was doing business with each other. I mean, business people were going to countries that they never imagined as possible markets. And Russia was in the G7 and it turned the G7 into the G8, actually. And it was part of the G20. And I think everybody hoped that this was an opportunity for Russia to become what the Russians like to call a normal country. And there is a great sense of regret among the people that I spoke to, particularly the Russians. There's an enormous sense of regret, a missed opportunity. And moreover, Giles, I think something that will probably take a generation to fix again.
The book is called Zero Sum, The Arc of International Business in Russia. It's by Charles Hecker, who's speaking to you today. Charles, if people want to find you online, I know you're online because I've been stalking you, and there is a website.
There is a website. The website is charleshecker.com. The book is available everywhere you like to shop, in person or online. And you can follow me on all the typical social media outlets.
And you can also order the book via our own virtual bookstore. The book is called Zero Sum. It's by Charles Hecker. Charles, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you this morning.
The pleasure's been mine. Thank you, Giles.